isn't it crazy what this war has done? You sit there shouting, we've won, we've won, we've won. All you've won is distrust of the nation. It wasn't the idea Iraq salvation, no. I'm sure I heard the word freedom said, but I see no freedom. I see the dead, I see wounded children and empty homes, wives without husbands and babies alone. Shelters made out of landmine shells, is freedom there? Live in hell. In that case, you've won your winter prize. What you ask, you can tell more lies now. The governments agree cover your back. Who's covering the back of civilians in Iraq now? I'm sure I heard the word freedom said, but I see no freedom. I see the dead, I see wounded children and empty homes, wives without husbands and babies alone. Shelters made out of landmine shells, is freedom there? Live in hell. You're still the leader, no damage done. Look to the aftermath, what you want now. Victims wander around asking why they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, but there wasn't a right time. They weren't to know they were being used as a reality TV show screen live all day on different stations, so others could watch their devastation with a packet of popcorn, a hand on the phone. They lived the war while we watched from home. We watched from a distance, always free from any effects that there may be. But what about Iraq? They didn't ask for the war that made them TV stars. Sure, I heard the word freedom said, but I see no freedom. I see the dead, I see wounded children and empty homes, wives without husbands and babies alone. Shelters made out of landmine shells, you've given them. You've given them living.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We're listening to Why Violence Has Declined with Harvard professor Steven Pinker, who's interviewed by Neil Conan, the host of Talk of the Nation on National Public Radio.
There have been people who have observed tribes in places like New Guinea in their warfare and noticed that they would stand about the maximum distance of their projectiles, their bows and arrows for the most part, or spears, launch them at each other. They were largely ineffectual, and that they would then retreat to their various camps, and, well, honor was satisfied. Yet you make an unsettling comparison to our closest primate cousins, the chimpanzees.
Yes. Well, the misleading thing about looking at tribal battles is that, indeed, the battles probably were largely symbolic. The two sides would kind of face each other across a distance. They talk trash at each other, insult each other's mothers, chuck spears that were usually just missed. And if one was killed, they'd call it a day. The thing is that where they really start to rack up high body counts is not in those spectacles, but in sneaky raids. A bunch of men from one village would surround another village at daybreak when the men would, when the people would get up out of the their huts to urinate in the morning. That's when the bows and arrows and the spears and the flaming the setting huts on fire would begin. So they were attackers aren't stupid. Why be out in the open and be the target of the other guy's spears if you could surprise them at dawn and kill them before they're organized enough to mount a defense? If you look at the deaths from raids, that's what jacks up the total body count. And so the pitched battles are misleading in that regard.
And indeed, it looks like the chimps do very much the same thing.
And chimpanzees do the same thing. Groups of males will patrol the edge of their border looking for members of some other community. And if they outnumber them by at least 3-1, then they'll tear the other chimp limb from limb. And this was a discovery made to her horror by Jane Goodall, and it's been replicated a number of times. So our cousins are pretty nasty, too.
So then there are the questions about the mechanisms by which we have gone from these horrific rates in antiquity. And one of the main questions is it our genes? Are we evolving?
It's not impossible, but I doubt it. I can't rule it out. It's certainly not possible for the changes that we've observed, say, in the last 70 years. So the dramatic decline in war since the end of World War II, it's only two generations. And the Germans went from the world's most warlike people to the world's biggest pacifists in less than two generations. That couldn't have been a genetic change because evolution has a speed limit measured in generations. It's not mathematically impossible that medieval Englishmen were genetically different from modern ones, but given that we can see rates of violence yo-yo up and down over a span of decades, we really don't have to bring in biology to explain change over centuries. We know that some kind of social and cultural mechanisms can change it in that short a time period.
Well, Elias, who we've been talking about, gave us some indications in terms of those mechanisms, Hobbes again with the Leviathan and the power of the state, but there had to be something else going on, and you've come up with, I thought, the most extraordinary idea of what it was, and that in fact it is our consciousness, our ability to reason.
Yes, I think that I tried to identify what went right, what have we been doing right that that has driven violence down, and I think that government has been one and commerce has been another. But yet another is reason, thinking, logic. That is, violence is a problem. If you think it through, it can't be a good thing for us to attack each other. I mean, granted, if I attack you and I win every time, it's good for me, but it's really bad for you. And I can't count on that lasting indefinitely. At some point, it's going to be me that's on the receiving end of violence.
Coming out of my tent to urinate in the morning.
Exactly, yes. So when you step back and instead of thinking, God damn it, they killed one of ours, we've got to kill one of theirs, and you think, geez, is there any way to live your life? Then you start to look for ways to reduce violence on both sides simultaneously. And that's the key, because the dilemma is you realize violence is dumb, but you can't be the only guy to beat his swords into plowshares, because if the guy over on the other side of the mountain range still keeps his swords as swords, you can be in trouble. The question is, how do you get both sides to lay down their arms simultaneously? That's a tough problem. No one solved it all at once. But the various individual mechanisms that I explain in the book all fall under the general umbrella of how do you solve the problem of getting everyone to reduce their violence at the same time? Just being a pacifist won't do it. And so, we come up with strokes of genius or blunder our way through changes in customs, keep the ones that seem to work, like the table manners. Government, particularly democratic government. I mean, the problem with government is you're basically substituting one kind of violence for another. You're substituting the violence of anarchy for potentially the violence of tyranny, for the Leviathan, the king that's going to threaten all of you.
Right. Tune in to great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays on Access Sacramento, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. See the big picture on financial, military, environmental crises, war and peace, the economy, and climate change are covered. And then there's music and humor. Challenge your thinking with great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And here she is, the hottest woman to ever govern the coldest state, Sarah Palin!
Hello, America! Oh, and hello to the great state of Washington, D.C. My name is... Sarah Palin! Yeah, that's it! And I'm here to talk right at you. Now, as you know, I got a book on the bestseller list, Going Rogue, and a lot of people have encouraged me to run for president in 2012. But of course, many of them are Democrats, but you betcha, yeah! Hey, but you know, seriously, folks, in the meantime, I haven't just been home making whale blubber brownies. No, sirree. I got a new job. It's on the Fox News. I'm going to be an on-air contributionist. You know, who'd have think after all these years of shooting Fox, Fox will be shooting me. But I'm a little disappointed. I'm going to have to cancel my global book signing tour. Yeah, that's too bad. I was really looking forward to seeing West Korea. Hey, speaking of which, you know, in my book, I have a whole chapter on my foreign policy experience. And on that page, there's a lot of interesting facts. But don't take my word for it. Take a look. See my quotes. Gee, I can't wait to see what I wrote. Starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's coming up roguey. If my book seems to boast, did you know it was written by ghosts? They quote God and the Todd, and they see to agree that I'm roguey. I'm not vicious, no, I'm an advocate for birds and fishes. Bald eagle is quite delicious. Sails are up, this is it, and the White House is where I will sit. I'll be swell, I'll be great, like I was in my state. As president, I'll be a roguette. And then 2 years into my first term, I'll announce that I quit. Okay, fine now.
The way to get the advantages without the disadvantages is basically democracy. That is, you have a government that is just powerful enough to prevent people from killing each other without doing more damage itself.
So you want a Jefferson rather than a Stalin.
Exactly. And it's not a coincidence that the framers of our Constitution were, they read their Hobbes, they read their Greek history, their Thucydides, they read their political theory, John Locke, and they actually thought out as an intellectual puzzle, how can we have a government that can justify itself, it's going to be better than anarchy, but that does only what we want a government to do, namely to allow people to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And so, and the whole Constitution was a kind of a geeky gadget to try to lay out rules that would reduce violence. Granted, the government's going to have to reserve some violence for itself, but let's keep it as small as possible. The United Nations was another one of those mechanisms. We talked about commerce and trade. After World War II, basically the Europe said, well, hey, let's not do that again. And they tried to think, well, what could make a... we thought we had it figured after World War I. Didn't work out so well. Can we do better this time? Just moralistic declarations that war is a bad thing didn't seem to be enough. League of Nations didn't quite do the job. One of the ideas they had is, well, if you have countries like, especially France and Germany, that kept fighting war after war, if they were in a commercial union, particularly for coal and steel, which is the two things you need most to fight a war, and they merged their markets, so there was no economic rivalry, maybe then we don't have to be angels, but it'll just be bad business to go to war. And so they set up the European Coal and Steel Union, a number of countries, which then became the European Common Market, which then became the European Union. We've got a lot of tension in the European Union now, but what we don't have is war. So Germany is probably not going to invade Greece. They're going to be sore. They're going to look down on the Greeks. But I don't think we're going to have a shooting war. And that's one of the strokes of genius of the post-war period, was to realize that you have a lot of... Or there's an old saying, when goods cross borders, armies don't. That's another stroke of genius, so another way we've applied our intelligence to reduce the problem of violence.
I wanted to ask you about another thinker that I had never heard of, and I will mispronounce his name, I am sure. It is Cesare Beccaria.
Oh, yes. He was another hero of this story. He was an Italian economist, today we might call him a sociologist as well, who had the idea that you could control crime without publicly disemboweling criminals or torturing them to death, breaking them on the wheel, pulling them apart by horses, all of the forms of entertainment that they had until the 18th century as a way of punishing criminals. Among other things, he thought, well, it really isn't the how gruesome the punishment is that matters. It's the probability of getting caught. Because if you have a horrible form of punishment, and that was the idea at the time, how you deter people, you just make the punishment as gruesome as possible, and that'll scare people straight. The problem is that if it's awful, but it hardly ever happens, you just think, well, it's like an accident. I mean, it'd be really horrible to get into a car accident, too, but it's not going to stop me from driving, because it'll be horrible if it does happen, but it probably won't. Same thing happens with gruesome, unlikely punishment. If you want criminal justice to work, you have it so the punishments aren't that horrible, but they're more likely to happen. Then people think twice before breaking the law. And he had a number of reforms like that where he just kind of figured out if the point of criminal punishment isn't to just satisfy our thirst for blood, to just punish bad people because bad people should be punished. But if we think the point of punishment is to deter crime, how do we rearrange punishments so that we get the most crime reduction for the least amount of pain inflicted?
It raises, though, a question, and his views were attacked after he published them, we learned in your book, but very quickly accepted. And these punishments faded very quickly, that things that had happened for millennia as, again, public spectacle. You quote from the diary of Samuel Pepys, who casually mentions going to see a man horribly killed for a crime
at
Charing Cross, and then offering his friends a bowl of oysters on the way home. This sort of thing had gone on forever. How did it stop?
Yes, it's quite a remarkable story in human history. And we sometimes forget, because we make jokes about these horrible punishments, like the rack. Pepys made a joke about the practice of drawing and quartering, which he had witnessed, which, by the way, consists of partly strangling a person, not letting him lose consciousness. Then you cut him open and take out his internal organs, castrate him, show him the organs while he's still conscious, burn them in front of him before finally strangling him. And the way Pepys described it is not only did he witness this, but he said that when the, and this was actually a, not some low-life criminal, but a general, he didn't say what the general was, what his infraction was, he said, and the executioner held up his heart and there were great cries of joy from the crowd. Then we all went out for oysters. another example is, you know, crucifixion. There can't be a, it's hard to think of a ghastlier way to die, but as we remember from the story of Jesus, he was crucified with a couple of thieves. And so it was a common form of punishment during the Roman Empire.
And we remember the end of Spartacus's army, the crosses lined up on the Appian Way.
Yes, exactly. So then, 18th century, everyone thinks the better of it, including our own prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment in the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. That occurred pretty much in the middle of a wave of abolitions of torture of European countries. And at the time, the bleeding heart versus tough on crime debate was, well, if you don't scare people with horrible torture and mutilation, then the crime rate will go through the roof. Why won't people just kill and stab each other? They have nothing to fear. And they were wrong. The homicide rate continued to fall even as the punishments got less gruesome.
Ed, you spoke a lot earlier about the function of reason. You talk about the age of reason and the Enlightenment and the importance of those eras. And to some degree, you seem to flinch away from religion. The Protestant Reformation had a great deal to do with both the age of reason and the Enlightenment.
Well, religion has a complicated role in this story. The problem with the Protestant Reformation is that it then led to the European Wars of Religion.
It did, but it also led to people being free to have greater ideas, too.
I think it was a product in part of the invention of the printing press, which also later unleashed a flood of ideas. But later, really, it was in the 18th century.
A writer goes for Gutenberg.
It was in the 18th century, first of all, that for the first time a majority of people in Western countries could read. It was the age in which books were affordable for the first time. There was a kind of Moore's law of economic efficiency of printing that really only happened in the 18th century. Books started to go viral. They were translated into multiple languages. They were discussed in coffee houses and salons and pubs. And I think that that had a lot to do with these enlightened ideas, including the American Constitution and Bill of Rights.
It's interesting, though, you say at one point that the secular humanism is not necessarily atheistic, but it doesn't seem to be religious either. It does not seem to allow for that. And again, you see the United States as both an exemplar in the Founding Fathers and an outlier in terms of what our society is like today.
Yes, well, the United States is the most religious Western country by far. Another way in which we're not a typical democracy. One of the reasons that the role of religion in the decline of violence is such a complicated story is that religions themselves are moving targets, at least a lot of them are. And religions have gotten far more liberal, progressive, ecumenical than they used to be. You know, most Christians aren't in favor of burning heretics anymore. Whereas it wasn't that long ago that that's what you did, or burning witches, belief in hell has gone down. And religions have gotten more touchy-feely. And I think the same movements that have deglamorized violence across the board have had an effect on religions. We see religions changing.
It's nature's way of Now for something completely different.